Hello and welcome to another episode of the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Greg Migliori. Joining me today on the phones, as always, is Road Test Editor Zach Palmer. How's it going, man?
Oh, it's going good over here. How's it going on your end?
It's going well. It's fall. It's kind of warm out, which is nice. Trees are starting to turn as I look across my yard, kind of down into the woods, which is nice. Feels pretty good. Maybe I'll, sit on the patio a little bit later. But, we got a great show for you guys today. Lots of news, stuff that I think people are going to get into. Let's see, the next-gen BRZ is confirmed, sort of stating the obvious, but now we know there's going to be a fall reveal date, fall as in this year, 2020. Not surprising. It's going to be related to the Toyota 86. I know you're blown away by this, Zach. But, I think it's good to hear that this thing is still in the works. Got some other things coming up too. It's the end of the line for some Jaguars, the XC and the XF wagon. The XF itself, the sedan, is getting a refresh. New Honda Ridgeline, pretty major refresh. They only showed one of the trims, at least initially. So, Zach, you wrote that. We're going to break that down. We're going to talk about a subject that both Zach and I like to just always talk about. That's the NSX. The sales are quite slow. We're just going to kind of take another lap around with the NSX about what the car is like. I wrote a review that just went up actually a couple weeks ago. Good opportunity to revisit that. Then we've got a couple of reviews for you. The Volkswagen Atlas, of course. Zach, you were in just the traditional SUV, correct?
Yep, just a normal Volkswagen Atlas, not the coupe cross sport that I know you drove.
That's what I drove earlier this summer. Had a good time in it. So it'll be good to talk about. So we'll do that, and then perhaps more exciting to the listeners is the Shelby GT350. In fact, maybe we'll even talk about that first in the reviews. But with that in mind, let's get underway. It's a, like I said, busy show. We're going to just run right through these. Plenty of news subjects here. So I'm excited to hear sort of like we used to even put this in headlines. We haven't in a while. It's officially official that the BRZ will be revealed. I think there was enthusiasts were a little nervous that, what was going on with this car. Makes a ton of sense to do it with Toyota, although kind of curiously, in the story written by one of our freelancers over in France, actually, Ronan Glan, that we haven't heard much from Toyota about what's up with the 86. Subaru's doing their car, let's put it that way. So I'm excited. Yep. This is one of those cars that if the world of press cars like ended for us automotive journalists, that would be sad. But this would be a car that would be on the short list for me. Probably wouldn't get a new one, might get a used one. It would definitely be like a third car. But to me, this is sort of like a modern classic, if you will. The steering, the chassis, the looks, it's got everything that harks back to some of those great 1960s and 70s sports cars that weren't super powerful. But they really, they did everything you wanted a sports car to do. So that's my like too long, don't read, don't listen take, but glad it's coming back as we thought.
Hey, me too. I know like you said there at the start, there was a point in time where I'm not really sure if there's going to be a next-gen BRZ 86. Like it's a slow-ish selling sports car, doesn't have a ton of appeal. So I am seriously pumped that they're bringing it back. We don't have enough of very cheap rear-wheel drive enthusiast focused coupes and vehicles out there these days. And honestly, like from the rumors and from what we've heard so far, it's gonna be fixing my biggest problem with it, which has always been the engine. It looks like the rumor is that it's going to get a 2.4 liter flat four as opposed to the 2 liter. A little more torque should hopefully fill in the big dead spot that the BRZ FRS and 86 have had for the longest time now. Even just another like 20-30 horsepower I feel is going to really wake that car up and make it something that I like even more than what it is now. But it's another interesting point what you make about Toyota there about, we haven't really heard anything from them about the 86. They've talked for a while now with the Supra, like, all right, so we have the Supra 3.0, that's our flagship sports car. Then we have the 86, that's our mid-tier. And then they came out with the Super 2.0 this year and said, well, this sort of bridges the gap between the 86 and the big fast Supra. You knock about $8,000 off the price and here you go. If they come back with an 86 that's a little faster, a little more expensive, that sort of, you know, lowers the gap between their super cheap one and their mid-tier super even more. I don't know if there's anything we should read into that. And, you know, maybe the 86 is not going to be, you know, the same thing as the BRZ. Maybe there'll be some more differentiation this time that the Toyota tries to slot it into their own lineup better. But no, this is probably, my most looking forward to reveal of the end of the year here. You know, I think a lot of people are looking forward to this reveal, honestly.
For sure. And I really think your point is really spot on there as far as getting an engine that gives you just a little bit more power. Because the car, candidly, as good as its reflexes are, could use a little more muscle. You know, I would like a little bit more beef in this car.
Yeah, no, like the Miata right now, I think, is just the right amount of power in that, you know, you're getting to 60 in about 6-ish seconds, whereas the BRZ, you're still sitting around 7, which, at that much of a disparity, I'd actually be more liable to take a Miata over this and lose the rear seats.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think I would still end with BRZ or 86, but, you know, it's just because I sort of prefer that, like, the whole setup of the car, if you will. And the Miata is its own kind of thing. But yeah. Okay, so some sad news out of Jaguar this week. The XE is going away. This sort of came out this week among a flurry of other announcements that the XF wagon is going to go away. And then the XF itself gets a nice upgrade, actually. I think it looks pretty good, some of the pictures we saw. I'm going to kick it right over to you, though. XE, going to be essentially gone. Your take?
Yeah, this is sort of a weird one here. So they did a whole mid-cycle, pretty, you know, comprehensive update to the XE for 2020. But it actually lost one of my favorite things about the car, was that 3-liter supercharged V6. And they went down to just two different 4-cylinder options, which to me made the car a lot less appealing. And I wouldn't doubt if it made the car less appealing to a lot of enthusiasts who are like, well, you know, this was a sort of unique option in this area. You could get a 3-liter supercharged V6, and, well, now it's gone. And now you can't even get the 4-cylinders. It's just completely going away. It's also a bit of a shame, just because the XE was one of the better driving sedans, I think, in this segment. Pretty good handler. I love the way it looked. You know, this and the Giulia were probably my two favorite looking, you know, luxury sports sedans out there. So yeah, pretty sad that it's going away. I might be even more sad about that one that you just mentioned, though, the XF Sport Break, the wagon, also going away. I'm sure that not a ton of people bought these, as Americans tend to do with luxurious wagons. I honestly only remember ever seeing like two of them on the road, like ever.
Both press cars, right?
Yeah, probably both press cars. I actually never got to drive one, but God, I love the way they look so much. I have a feeling that it's the F-Pace's fault, which is fine. People want to buy crossovers. That's the way of the world right now. But it's a real shame seeing both of these, you know, fun to drive, interesting looking Jaguars going away. Maybe you have similar thoughts on disappearance too.
To pick it up, the XE is one of the better handling Jaguars. I mean, sedan Jaguars that I think I've ever driven. I mean, it really, the chassis was so dialed in. The steering was outstanding. The interior was okay. Frankly, the looks of the car, I think it was very trim specific. I think at its like lower trims, it looked almost a little too pedestrian. But as you dress it up just a little bit, it really began to like affect that like Jaguar uniqueness and specialness. And overall, it was a very handsome car. I think that almost speaks to the fact that, like, the segment in general, you were seeing, like, you know, Civics and Fusions, you know, just that size of car were getting pretty styled up. So then when you're an actual luxury brand, it's a little tougher to stand out. But I still think they managed to do that. But again, the dynamics were amazing. Right from the start, you know, one of our previous editors did a really great review of this, did an extensive track test, just how competitive this was with, like, the Germans. So I'm very sad to see it go. We had a diesel, which was a very unique thing in this segment as part of the Autoblog long-term fleet. It was super surreal to pull up to, like, a gas station and get in line behind, like, a really big truck in this, like, small Jaguar. And, you know, on more than one occasion, somebody would say, "Hey, man, this is diesel. Like, what are you doing here?" And I was like, "Nope, I'm here. I'm here for the diesel." And he'd look at the car and he'd look at me and they'd be like, "All right, sure. You know, you fill up your car with diesel. If that's what you want to do." And so that was, you know, I thought, like, to your point too, that Supercharged 6, really interesting portfolio of powertrains you could get in the XE. Styling, I think, was good. The handling was outstanding. So yeah, I mean, I'm sorry to see it go, but sedans, smaller sedans, there's not a huge market for them. So to me, that makes perfect sense. And then when you get into the wagon, that's the exact thing I just said, only writ large, you know, even maximize it. You know, there's no market for, like, sport break, you know, really styled up station wagons. So, I mean, we had an XF sport break, I believe it was 2 winters ago. And the press cars that come and go as we review them, sometimes they stick, sometimes they don't. But I remember, like, people were like fighting over this car. It was gorgeous. And people, you know, I feel like it was red, bright red, and it was just like, oh wow, you know, everybody wanted it, you know. So, but again, not much of a market, you know. What do you get it, like, who's the market for this car? If you need capability, most likely you want, like, a crossover or something, you know. So it
Yeah,
goes.
I think that part of the, I don't know, like, silver lining is that, you know, these cars are going away, but at the same time, like, there are a ton of really great options, you know, as far as sports sedans go. You can get a Giulia, you can get yourself a 3 Series, the new Acura TLX, really, really great. And then even in the wagons, Audi has come out with their A6 Allroad that you can get now. And if you have an especially large sum of cash lying around, there's the RS6 Avant. So you're still, like, not without options. They're just sadly not going to be Jaguar options. I bet maybe if you really want one of those XF sport brakes, may be able to get, like, a super screaming deal on one of them right now, because they're just sort of just sitting around on the lot. I guarantee there aren't many of them, and they're just attempting to get rid of the last few that there are.
Wow, that's a tempting thought. I need to really maybe see if there's any out there. Not that I'm in the market for a Jaguar station wagon, but that's a cool car. And I would take the XF Sport Break over any of those Audis you mentioned. And I do like those Audis. You know, they're very capable, special in their own way. But yeah, man, sorry to see it go. But maybe we should talk about a market that is super rich right now, and that's pickup trucks. The new Ridgeline is out. You wrote that piece. I mean, obviously, right away they totally changed a good chunk of the look. In large part, I think to make it stand out a bit from more from, like, the Pilot, on which it shares the same like crossover sort of platform. You know, they're both unibody, and I think it's also sort of like, I'll call it like the Ranger or the Gladiator effect. When the Ridgeline, it's been around actually for a while, and it always was kind of its own thing. It was a little bit different than the Colorado. It was a bit different than the Tacoma. More of like just this practical truck, capable. You could tow with it. Somewhat fuel efficient. Looks were a little understated. Some would call them plain, subtle, elegant is another way to look at it. It's a classy truck. We had a long-termer that I loved. I put a ton of stuff into it. we had a short timer come through the summer, and I went and got a ton of mulch and dirt and things like that. Not literally a ton, but you know, when you're using pickup trucks, you can't really, you know, exaggerate those things. But I mean, why don't you just break it down? What are we looking at here? You know, my takeaway is it seemed like they felt like they had to sort of give this truck a more purposeful look to sort of maintain pace with the rest of the field. But I'd like to hear your take.
Yeah, no, you wouldn't actually be able to put a whole ton of mulch into the bed. It has a 1,580-pound payload capacity. So, but that's another point. In general, you know, I think, you know, this truck changed exactly what it needed to change. I loved pretty much everything about it. Like you mentioned, we had that long-termer. I put a ton of miles on that thing. You know, it's the most comfortable, quiet, easy driving truck there is out there. Has a ton of really thoughtful features in it, like the swing out bed and the actual trunk under the bed itself. Just super, super pleasant, you know, truck that sort of drives like a crossover. That was the beauty of it. The ugly part of it was the fact that it sort of looked like a Honda Odyssey. Or, you know, to be a little nicer, even a Pilot from the front. Didn't really look like a truck at all. But this redesign, you know, they completely changed all the sheet metal from the A-pillars forward. So you get a new, you know, nice, really big, bulging, muscular hood, a huge grill up there, you know, it's sort of in your face, new headlights, new bumper. They throw a skid plate on there. The only pictures they showed us are actually of this HPD package that you can get on it with these fancy gold wheels and big blocky plastic arches. It's a little overdone in that. I think I wouldn't go for those gold wheels or this sort of. I think the arches are a little tacky and not completely thought out. But just, you know, the front end really was the big issue with this truck. And I think that, you know, this redesign will, you know, actually help it appeal more to truck buyers while you are retaining all the really, really good parts about it that it used to have. So to me, huge, huge win for this redesign. I think that Honda will probably sell more of them because of this.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think they did the proverbial cliche, they like, you know, toughened up the front, if you will. I'm not sure I like it more. I'll need to see it in like some other trims, see how just like what a more conventional one looks like, because, you know, like the Trail Boss for the Silverado full-size truck is a lot different than some of the other, you know, Silverado trims. So, you know, I'm going to withhold judgment. I was in the minority. Like, I really like the old truck. So I guess I'm actually a little bit like, well, hey, what are you doing here? You know, you're kind of messing with, you know, this pretty good execution. I think another thing too is in real life, nobody ever walked up to the truck, at least when I had it, and they were like, oh, that's a small truck, or you know what? Most people when they saw it, they were like, oh, that's a pretty big truck. Wait, what are you driving there? You know, like, so I feel like it. Maybe some of these figures didn't carry over to the pictures, you know, and part of it was a marketing thing. But I mean, legitimately, you know, to your point, though, it did have too much of a crossover vibe. And obviously that's why they felt they needed to change it, because there is a true truck market now. When they originally launched the Ridgeline, I remember them saying things like, well, we think this is actually like, we could steal some crossovers from other maybe makes, you know, people who aren't quite happy with, like, you know, their options. You know, they weren't trying to cannibalize themselves, but they were trying to, you know, get like sort of that in between, you know, white space, you know, vehicle. And, you know, I mean, I think in some sense they succeeded, but then a decade plus later, they're left with kind of a generic truck. So.
Yeah. And I mean, whenever anybody honestly asks me like, hey, what truck should I buy? Like, I always ask them, like, all right, so how much do you need to tow? Like, are you going to tow much more than 5,000 pounds? If the answer is no, I essentially recommend the Ridgeline almost every single time, just because it's actually comfortable to drive around, to daily. And honestly, like if even if you're in the market for a crossover, like say a Honda Pilot or a Kia Telluride, and you don't need a third row, buy a Ridgeline because you're not really taking any penalty, but you're getting all the advantages of a bed, and it's you can do a whole lot of things with it that you might not have been able to before. So, yeah, no, I'm excited about this. The one small design detail that I feel like maybe we can all get behind is this new dual exhaust design they have out back. I think that's very cool. They're almost sort of copying like a Ram or sort of like a Raptor that has a cool dual exhaust just like coming right out from the bumper. It's not like a side exit like a lot of trucks. Just looks a lot more aggressive and sporty. And that's just on the standard truck too, that it has that. Just a nice
Agreed.
little small but noticeable touch that I like.
I thought that was very thoughtful. I thought they were like, what can we do that will like actually add something here? And yeah, that was a very well considered enhancement, I think. So staying with the like the greater Honda family, Honda Motor Co., let's shift over to Acura. The NSX is quite slow selling. I believe I saw a report that said something like 26 were sold. I want to say last year, this year, which is a tiny amount. I just drove one earlier this year. I know you spent a lot of time in one. You have a lot of strong feelings about the NSX. Why do you think that, we're seeing such slow performance? Is it, and there's a couple of reasons I can think of. One is like right now, people aren't buying cars as much. They're not buying supercars as much. There's no need to really, in the middle of a pandemic necessarily, seek out some of those like sporting opportunities that you might do, although you could argue you could do them socially distant and much of the world is reopening, so I don't know how much that plays into it. But for whatever reason, it seems to be not moving as well as some of these other super sports cars that we see. So, I mean, I like it. I think it's a sophisticated take in a segment that often relies on like brute force and sort of carbon fiber in your face. But maybe that's it, is it's a little too nuanced. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, man, I like you said, I have a lot of thoughts on the original NSX and this new NSX. Obviously the new one has been around for a decent amount of time now. So you have a lot of people that maybe wanted them already. They've already bought them, first of all. And you had a like the biggest change of going through this generation in 2019, where they actually did improve some things. They made the steering a lot better, the suspension was better, just the whole way the car drove as a cohesive piece was greatly improved, which is a shame because people are not buying them now, unfortunately. I mean, some of the biggest reasons that I could see for that. You're charging a base price of around $160,000 for it, and for that price, you could also walk into Porsche dealer and pick yourself up a 911 GT3. If for whatever reason the NSX you're looking to buy has a bunch of options on it, I mean the one that I tested was almost 200,000 at $196,000 before. For that price, you can go get yourself a McLaren, and it just, I think a lot of supercar buyers, and I'm sort of generalizing here, but a lot of people that buy that car, you're buying it for the performance, but you're also buying it for the badge. And an Acura doesn't necessarily scream supercar premium. I have lots of money, but a McLaren, on the other hand, yeah, it totally does. And that's no indictment on the way the NSX drives or anything like that. I think it's a brilliant driver with the combination of the hybrid power and that twin turbo V6. It gives you all the brute force acceleration that you get in one of the McLarens with their twin turbo V8s. and very similar to a 911 turbo 911 GT3, what have you. It's just, man, there's just not enough people out there that seem to want the car, and which is weird, because you know there was so much excitement around when it was actually coming back, and it was such a long drawn out reveal process. I know that maybe could have turned some people off. It definitely turned some people off with the Supra. For like years we were hearing about that car, and everybody was just like, give the car to us already. So yeah, just a whole combination of things just, I think, have led to us now seeing, like you said, about 20-ish sales this year, which is, it seems way, way too low for, you know, a car that has an entire factory dedicated to building it in Ohio. It's a really cool factory, but I'm afraid they're just not putting out many cars these days.
28, I should say. So we shorted them two. But I mean, there's a great piece about, we do this zombie cars sort of gallery. There are actually two Dodge Vipers sold last month somehow. So it's like, granted, this is like trivia, basically. Like they were on a lot or something, still somehow sold as new. But I mean, I think that speaks just to the fact that, like, you know, this car is, you know, maybe its life cycle is starting to run a little bit. You know, I drove the refreshed one with all those enhancements, which do make a difference, I think. I think it's, you know, it's not enough that if you could, I don't know, get a used NSX, you know, that I would say, hey, pay more. Like if you somehow had like some sort of deal through your local supercar broker, I guess. but I mean, they do make the car better. Like Acura is not letting the car languish. It's still a very competitive, interesting car, but the price is a really good point there that you make, Zach. And that's that, I mean, McLarens, Porsches feel special, you know, and you do get the badge. And I mean, you see it throughout other parts of their lineup, you know, like we'll get to this on a future podcast, but I'm in a 718 Cayman right now, the T model, if you will. It's got like 300 horsepower. It's $72,000. It has cloth door strap handles. Yeah, I mean, there's parts of it that are a little conflicting, but at the end of the day, you're like, well, it handles well, it's fast, it looks good, it's a Porsche. I'm okay with that. And you sort of rationalize the rest of it, and then you kind of look at Acura and you say, well, their brand's maybe not quite, it's obviously not quite as strong as Porsche, or even like McLaren, you know? So, I mean, maybe that's, you know, I think another part of it is too, and again, it's not necessarily about a business, like a bunch of, like, raw production for the NSX, because it's never going to be a big volume, even in like normal times. But I kind of wonder if everybody who wanted one already has one right now, you know, and that's sort of where it is.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a sort of real possibility out there. And, you know, the advantage that they, you know, that the original NSX had, and that it was this super reliable, easy to use supercar in a world of very unreliable, you know, finicky supercars from Ferrari, Lamborghini, you know, anything out of Britain was like, oh, watch out, the electronics are going to go out after 100 miles on a rainy road. Well, all the other supercars are just fine now. You know, they've all learned, and their cars are reliable. They're not, you know, just a constant mess in and out of the dealership. And, you know, that advantage that Acura had is sort of just dwindled to almost nothing. It's still, you know, I still think that they have a bit of an advantage in, like, calling it the everyday supercar, just because it is so easy and simple to drive. Like, you can throw it in hybrid mode. And honestly, like, anybody that has not driven a supercar, anybody that you could have driven the like 150 horsepower Corolla for your whole life, I feel like you could hop into an NSX and not be overwhelmed by what's going on, just because it is that simple and easy to drive. Which, as I'm saying, that could almost be a bit of a turnoff for somebody who wants, you know, something with atmosphere, and you know it's gonna, you know, hit you in the head 100% of the time you're driving it. You know, that's sort of what you get in a Ferrari or Lamborghini mid-engine supercar. So you have those sort of polar opposites. It's just the philosophy that Honda Acura has with their supercar. They had it in the beginning, and it's the same now. There's a limited crowd of people who want those certain elements in a $160,000 to $200,000 sports car, I suppose.
Yeah, no, great point. So let's transition to another car that's actually on the way out. That's the Shelby Mustang GT350. Should point out the NSX is not on its way out, but another car that is a relatively low volume. You got to drive this. It was one of the final drives, probably the final drive of this car from the press fleet anyway. Sounds like a very fun drive. I've always been a big fan of the GT350. I sort of like the precision, the right amount of balance and power that car offers, as opposed to the GT500, which is just like, raw in your face force. Obviously, check out the story. Zach's reviews are up, and as well as his piece, sort of, exploring the end of, the GT350 and what it all means. But yeah, wrap it up for us. How'd you feel about this car?
Yeah, man, I have a sort of a weird personal connection with this car. Going back to when it launched in 2015, I was actually working as a Roush test driver, where we'd test drive a bunch of random Fords and Lincolns. We'd drive them around for 8 hours a day, and I got to drive around the GT350 when I was doing that, and it was one of the first Mustangs I ever drove. It was like the first really expensive, fancy, awesome sports car that I really got to have my way with. And I fell in love with it then, like completely. It became my attainable dream car. All throughout college, I was like, man, one day when I have enough money, I'm gonna buy this car. And there's a few, pretty simple reasons why, and the reasons for why I wanted it then are pretty much the same reasons for why I love it now and why it gets so much praise. Number one being that Voodoo 5.2 liter V8, which who knows what the future of that engine is. The flat plane crank V8, 526 horsepower, 8,250 RPM. It's just the best word I can use for it is just scintillating. It's just such an intense, awesome, immediate, powerful engine that revs to the sky. I'm always a sucker for something with really exotic, high revving engine, and this one really does it for me. There's they did a whole lot to the suspension of the GT350, almost to the point where it doesn't even feel like a normal Mustang. Like you can hop out of a 5.0 and into a GT350. And it's almost like hopping out of this a 911 Carrera and then hopping into, say, a 911 GT3. It honestly seems like if Ford, if the Porsche GT, sporting team were to build a Mustang, it would be that GT350. It's elevated that much beyond a normal Mustang. That whole experience in a car that, at the start it was about $50,000. Now at by the end it's about $61,000, $62,000. It's honestly that price gap isn't a horrible climb for how good of a car was and how much praise it earned. But all good things must come to an end. Ford cited the fact that the GT500 is a thing now. And it when you look at the price of like the GT350R versus the GT500, the GT500 is actually a few hundred dollars cheaper, which is pretty weird considering that the GT500 has so much more horsepower. No, like the 350R is they sort of call it their track, very very track focused, whereas the 500 is a little more grand touring unless you go for the super expensive carbon pack. But yeah, no, we'll have to wait to see what Ford has in store for us for the next gen Mustang. Obviously, they could bring the GT350 back. They could bring that engine back, assuming emissions, everything's good there. I'm not really sure how how that'll shake out in a few years when the next gen Mustang comes. But yeah, I'm super, super sad to see this one go. And I guarantee you that I will be on the used market probably not too long. I don't know, a couple years. I'll wait for values to start to drop a little bit and be looking to pick one up myself, which is, I don't say that about many cars, but this one's that good.
I think it's part of the natural evolution of the Mustang lineup too. You know, they tend to bring in the different Shelbys and bring them out, bring in like Bullitt, bring in, you know, just all the different, you know, great Mustang names that we like, you know, we know and love, and then some are around and then some disappear, you know, Mach 1 is coming back. Of course there's Mach E, which is kind of its own, you know, in its own stable, to use a horse cliche. Yeah, I know. So bad. But I mean, it is part of the natural life cycle. And I guess kind of quickly here, you did get to drive one, you know, your review is up. I encourage everybody to check that out. But just quick thumbnail thoughts of the car driving it.
Yeah. I mean, so I think it's just about the right acceleration. You know, you're 0-60 in about 4 seconds. You have a pretty long first gear, shorter second and third, awesome to play with on a back road. I think that they've improved the steering feel and the weighting of it over the years. I actually think that this 2020 car is a lot better than the original 2015 that I drove. And also those magnetic shocks, I think, have gotten better over the years, as far as, you know, finding that right balance between nice, comfortable ride, but also being, you know, rock solid stiff through the corners. My biggest issue, honestly, with you know, driving hard on a back road is the tram lining. If you're not on a perfect road, it has a tendency to follow the curves and undulations of the road, and you really have to watch yourself and watch what you're doing. Otherwise, you'll find yourself edging over to the side of the road or into the middle of the road. You just have to really keep a tight grip on the steering wheel, and that's just a factor of the suspension design being, you know, set up for the track, and the super sticky Michelin Pilot Sport Cup 2 tires as well. But yeah, no, the sound really is the overarching, like, awesome part of the whole drive. I honestly believe, like, you cannot drive something else that under $100,000 that sounds better than this engine going all the way up and past 8,000 RPM. They still to this day, I mean, I thought this when I drove the original, like, the brakes are some of the best feeling, you know, right at the top of the pedal, super stiff feeling. It's not something that you know, might point out in other cars that don't have as good of brakes as this, but they're just that good and that impressive, and you know, really instills a sense of confidence in you that I do feel a need to point them out, because they're just better than other sports cars, which just adds to the whole driving experience. You know, it's that sort of thing. Like, sure, you don't have the fancy luxurious interior that you would in a $100,000+ sports car, but don't really want or need that. You know, you can get all the performance in a much cheaper package. So yeah, so long to the GT350. Will definitely be missed by me.
Very cool. Me as well. Yeah, me too. I have good memories. I did one of those right seat, like, ride and drives at Grattan, which is a small track in kind of the middle of nowhere here in Michigan, right when they first launched this car, and drove around with some of the, like, the Ford test engineers who, you know, really put that car, like, you know, on the razor's edge, if you will, and really capable. But let's wrap things up here with the Volkswagen Atlas. There's really no way to transition from a Shelby Mustang to a Volkswagen crossover, but it's important.
Yeah.
You had one for a week or so.
It's actually sitting in my driveway right now.
Still in your driveway.
It.
All right.
Yeah.
And is this the two-row or the three-row?
This is the three-row. Okay. And it has the base engine, actually. It's the 2-liter turbo but it also has all-wheel drive. Okay. That was something new that they did for 21 when they updated the car. So it is, there is something new here, and it is worth talking about because they did some design changes. I think that the front end looks a little classier now than it used to. We got some fancy new LED lights in front and back. It gives it a more modern look, I think. However, I honestly think like the biggest issue with this car before was just the super drab and plain interior. I mean, you don't really expect something like flashy in this class, but at the same time, like this is just about as drab and plain as it gets. Like even a Pilot, a Telluride, Palisade, Explorer, pretty much all of them have a little more, you know, pizzazz, interesting trim, shapes, design going on inside. And it just, you know, get that in this Atlas. It's a very, you know, this is a big, blocky American crossover and not much excitement. There are two things that they updated that I like more about the interior. It gets a new infotainment system. It's a new 8-inch touchscreen. It's a lot faster than the previous one. I think it works a lot nicer. And it just looks, it has a nice glossy black appearance, sort of upscale, get like tiny, like cheap Audi vibes. Not completely there, but the response and user experience is verging on that. Then I really like the steering wheel too. They gave it like almost a steering wheel out of a car. Which I always like. I never like, you know, when there's a big blocky steering wheel, feels like a truck. I know that some people may want that in a big crossover, but this almost feels like the steering wheel out of a Golf. It's very thin, and just a really nice feel in the hand. Was more than I was expecting for a crossover. So, I mean, driving it is just about the same as it was before. Comfortable, you know, decently quiet inside. That engine is plenty torquey, for, you know, just me in there. Maybe if you fill it up, you know, all three rows and luggage, might want the V6 at that point. But, the biggest thing I think I was missing in the driving right now is there's like no active safety features at all on this thing. It's the SE. So it's the trim level just above the base, $37,800 for those counting. And it doesn't have anything like lane departure, no lane keep assist, no adaptive cruise. And I just feel like that should almost be a standard feature on something like a family crossover, where safety is typically top of mind for, you know, the people buying the thing. I know that a lot of other manufacturers do make all that stuff standard. You look at any Toyota or Honda these days, and they have the full suite of safety equipment there standard for you. So that's was just a bit of a miss and disappointment I feel like they could have come out with when they had this mid-cycle refresh. So, but I know that you had the Cross Sport well.
That's a better segue than my transition. I had the Cross Sport a while back, and what really struck me is this reminds me of almost like a discount or sort of poor man's like X4 or X6, because I thought it really did look that good. I thought it really affected the like premium sporty look that some of those like BMWs do, but at a much lower price. Very attractive. I thought it actually did look like sort of like that coupe styled crossover that is cliched, but in this case, the roof and the hatch was kind of, you know, curved down and looked sporty. It had the big wheels. It had the right amount of trim, which, and by that I mean it was, you know, there were some nice like finishings and pieces that like made it sort of pop, but it wasn't like crazy like some of these like sort of like cartoon almost like sport appearance packages you see. And I mean, I think in a way I'm surprised you don't see more of these. Like Ford, I am surprised almost hasn't gone down this road. I mean, they have the Explorer, which is just like, you know, bread and butter, money, printing, you know, all that things as far as a cliche in that segment, although it's a reality for Ford. But I actually think there is more room in sort of like the crossover coupe, like mainstream market, you know, and I think Volkswagen's doing it right. In a way, not in a way, this, the the Atlas I drove felt more interesting and special than the last like conventional just three row or more traditional SUV style than what you had. Now, granted, I haven't driven it since the refresh, but it's still, I mean, relatively similar. And I think the Atlas in general, like especially the SUV style, gets lost in the field with all the domestics, which are strong. With, I mean, really almost everybody has an SUV in this segment that is generally quite competitive. So,
yeah, no, I mean, as I sit here and look at photos of the Cross Sport, yeah, I mean, sort of makes me think, why are the others not doing this too? Because I mean, some of the crossover coupes I think look a bit bloated and almost just like overweight for their own ungainly proportions. But this one's slick, it's sharp, it has some really nice lines on it. And honestly, like it's one of the few crossover coupes that I can get behind. I think that Volkswagen Audi have that design down better than everybody right now. Like the Audi Q8, I think is an awesome foil to the Q7. You know, it's sort of a crossovery coupe style, and even the Porsche Cayenne coupe is similar. And just the proportions are right, the lines are right. Unfortunately, I think that BMW and Mercedes are missing in the styling department for their crossover coupes these days. But I don't know, if you had to choose, would you go the just a normal big Atlas or the Atlas Cross Sport?
Depends on what I was doing. If it was sort of like my main like family hauling vehicle, I'd probably get the main Atlas, if you will. Just because, you know, you want as much space as you possibly can. And I believe the Cross Sport only comes with two rows, which would make sense. There's mm-hmm. no third row back there. So if I was looking for like a family hauling SUV, you know, to put like my family and my dog in, you may have heard her barking earlier. Like, I think you want the SUV. But if it was more of like sort of like the commuter car, if you will, like maybe one parent in the like the family is like, you know, whatever your childcare arrangement is, but like, you know, you're taking the kids to school or something, and then the other parent is maybe commuting by themselves or something, or just you wanted like more of a crossover, you know, car-like crossover, then this is more of the viable option. But yeah, I mean, if I needed one to haul everybody around, I'd probably do the SUV. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, so I sort of look at the Atlas Cross Sport as an alternative to the Tiguan.
Sure.
In that, you know, they're sort of similar size, although you can even get a third row in the Tiguan these days.
Yeah, I forgot about that. That's weird.
But no, if you're considering a two-row Tiguan, you know, maybe consider spending a little bit more money. You can get this far more stylish vehicle with, to me, a more interesting engine option in the 3.6-liter V6.
For sure.
Above the 2-liter turbo in the Tiguan. But, yeah, just like you said, you know, if I'm, for some reason, hauling a bunch of people around constantly, which not currently my lifestyle, I would have to go for the big Atlas in Volkswagen's lineup. But do keep that Cross Sport in mind if for whatever reason you're considering a Tiguan, I think.
It's very cool. Yeah, I mean honestly, that's why like literally 3 months after I have driven it originally, I'm like, hey, let's talk about it. Because it really did sort of stay with me. It was a cool crossover. So
yep. Lots of curb appeal. Lots of it.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have this week on the Autoblog Podcast. Thanks for listening. Be safe out there. Have a great weekend. Enjoy fall. And we'll see you next week.